I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Before we start the episode, I want to let you know about one quick thing. Unmistakable Creative t-shirts are now available for sale. You can learn more about them at unmistakableart.com. We have them in pink, red, and gray, and they're available for both men and women. And they were designed by our special projects artist, Mars Dorian, whose work you've seen anytime you visited the Unmistakable Creative website. And they look really cool. Now, let's get into today's episode. In this episode of the podcast, Moleskine's director of brand and PR, Eric Fabian, talks to me all about how a notebook can serve as a platform for your imagination and the pillars for building an iconic brand. Eric, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Hey, thanks. I'm really stoked to be here.
Yeah, it is really, really cool to have you here. You know, Mike Rohde, a former guest, connected both of us, and he mentioned that you are the director of marketing and PR at Moleskine. And given that I am somebody who lives and dies by these notebooks, I mean, I have stacks of them. I literally just opened a new one today. I figured, you know, this had to be an interesting conversation and one we had to have. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your story, your journey, your background, and how that has led you to this really cool job, it sounds like?
Sure, yeah. Well, I'll give you specifically where I sit now is I am the director of brand and PR at Moleskine America. So my world, my kind of scope is all of the Americas from Canada down to Latin America. And, you know, my day-to-day is like, you know, my responsibility is to kind of uphold and share the values that are really behind the Moleskine brand, you know, to kind of increase ultimately the kind of love people feel for the brand. Mm-hmm. And I think I got here through probably a rather untraditional path. My background's in the arts, doing things like theater and performance art. I, you know, went to a kind of an experimental college for undergrad and then got an MFA from art school for my graduate experience. And, you know, I've always been somebody who's just very curious. You know, I like to learn. You know, it's probably my kind of central hobby in life. And I, you know, I've always been interested in kind of people and how they interact and kind of shaping those interactions through creating events and different kinds of experiential kind of projects. And, you know, the kind of long story short, I, you know, as I, when I came to New York after grad school, you know, I consulted for a while. I was doing kind of experiential kind of event type work for marketing companies, as well as doing kind of group facilitation around ideation and different kinds of, you know, things to help nonprofits, whether for kind of strategic planning or other sorts of things like that. And I just kind of stumbled into meeting somebody who was, you know, looking for somebody in kind of a PR and events role at Moleskine. Initially, I thought they were somebody I was going to kind of pitch a brainstorm to, you know, something that, you know, they were asking me like, hey, do you know any Williamsburg creatives? And you know, I thought I could, you know, bring some people together to kind of help them ideate around some issue or something. But, you know, it turned out they were looking for somebody who, you know, understood the, you know, the kind of core fan base of that, you know, really enjoy Moleskine. And it just kind of ended up being a good fit.
So I definitely want to talk about that in a bit more depth, but you know, one of the things that's always interesting to me is to look at sort of the formative experiences and moments of significance, you know, in people's adolescence and early life that would ultimately lead them down the path that they would go on. And I'm curious what some of yours were.
Well, I suppose formative experiences. I think that, you know, I always was kind of a curious person, and you know, I read a lot. I grew up pre-internet, and you know, so I spent a lot of time with books. I consumed a ton of media, and you know, in the form of television and movies. And you know, I kind of moved around a bit when I was younger, and had you know, kind of the experience of eventually kind of tiptoeing my way from maybe kind of doing things more like sports and such into kind of finding like theater and, you know, doing kind of creative activities and getting involved with creative people. And I think that I always was somebody, you know, even very young who, you know, liked to put on shows for my parents, my grandparents, and, you know, liked to kind of imagine scenarios when I was playing with toys. And, you know, I put together huge kind of, you know, battles and such with, you know, the things I would play with as a kid. And I think that something about like the combination of like an inherent interest in like organizing things and kind of a joy for kind of, you know, making jokes and kind of making people laugh and, you know, and, you know, getting up and kind of performing, doing improvisation, you know, stuff like that, kind of led me down the route. And I think that, you know, for a long time, I don't know if I knew what I wanted to do with myself. But I, you know, was taking some classes, some college classes, you know, right after high school in the town I was living in Virginia. And I had one teacher who was a, you know, kind of art teacher who, you know, was taking just kind of foundation kind of art class. And she was somebody who, like, you know, I made some sketch or something, and she actually said to me, is like, you know, art is something that you should do. And, you know, even now that still stands out as one of the moments that kind of just broke through the haze, where somebody actually said, hey, this is something that you should consider doing. And, you know, it's something I took pleasure in. And while I didn't necessarily become like a visual artist or any, you know, anything along those lines, I always kind of think of myself more in terms of relationships and space and, you know, in other ways. I think something about that sensibility was definitely very much a part of me from that age. I don't know. I think that, you know, my parents divorced when I was young. I developed relationships and found, you know, moving around a lot. I think there was also something inherent about doing theater when I was young that was like really connected to the spirit of play, and mm-hmm. something that, you know, I think gets lost as you kind of transition into adolescence and, you know, life becomes much more serious and, you know, people are trying to, kind of suddenly, you know, girls and boys are looking at each other different. And I think that there's a certain innocence and kind of a real sense of community that's inside that world that really appealed to me mm-hmm. when I was young. So I think, you know, some of those things were probably strong kind of impact influences, initially. Mm.
So why do you think it is that, as adults, we lose that sort of boundless creativity and sense of play that you spoke of?
Wow. Well, you know, I think people talk about it a lot, and I think, you know, there's certainly just the kind of pragmatic stuff of like, you know, we have to feed ourselves and we have to work to achieve that. And it takes our time, and we often are doing things that we don't necessarily always enjoy. And I think that, you know, probably for a lot of people, there's a sense of kind of, you know, maybe embarrassment or kind of worry about how you're perceived and all that kind of stuff as you get older, and you know, their livelihoods might be tied to it or their sense of social status. I was somebody that didn't buy into that. I suppose I've always kind of really trusted my sense of joy in that sense and found it very important. But, you know, I think that, you know, I remember being in like my 20s, particularly, you know, I was in my 20s in the 90s, and, you know, there was the strong kind of creative kind of explosion and kind of a sense of kind of a lot of irony and a lot of kind of feeling of like our adolescence, you know, kind of shaped us and we've lost this precious thing in our youth. And I think there is a way of thinking about this that, you know, is a little bit not true, in the sense that, you know, I don't think childhood is specific, you know, it's really enlightenment. You know, I don't think the innocence of childhood is equal to kind of the transcendence of like, you know, the things that we feel confine us as adults. I think in some ways there's a kind of, there's a joy to that kind of naivete and the openness, but I think there's also just a sense of, you know, kind of developmentally you are kind of more egocentric and more kind of, you know, just aware of yourself and a smaller kind of world around you. And as you grow, you know, I've kind of always bought into this developmental idea that, you know, transcend and include things, and you kind of, as you kind of expand as a person and your consciousness, you are aware of a greater world and you're aware of yourself within that world, and you have kind of a position in that world, and I think negotiating what that is takes time. And so I think sometimes what gets lost perhaps is this sense of play, because you realize that you impact the world in a much more powerful way, and that the world also isn't just there to kind of serve your pleasures and, you know, your kind of moment to moment kind of, you know, kind of need. So, I, you know, I think that, you know, it's a complicated issue for sure.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when I listen to you describe that, I think about surfers. I'm an avid surfer and I learned to surf when I was 30. And I always wonder if little kids see it as this spiritual practice as an adult does. Like, their entire concept of it must be so different than mine, because at that age, what do you really know about spirituality and transcending yourself and these kinds of things?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, I mean, you don't know much of anything. You're just kind of like, you just don't have a large enough body of experience. And like, I think that you may have urges and kind of things that feel right that kind of guide you a bit. And mm-hmm. then you have the good fortune or, you know, the bad luck to be exposed to a different kind of set of things. But, but at the end of the day, you know, it's like, I don't mean to frame like one kind of person is like more holy or something than a child or, you know, anything like that. But the, but I do think that, the richness of life kind of expands with more experience and more kind of understanding, and the capacity to kind of take that into account is kind of the magnificent opportunity of life. And I'm really interested. Actually, I'm about to become a dad, and my I have a son that's about to be born in a few weeks, and I'm really curious to kind of, as somebody who's, you know, I'm approaching fatherhood for the first time a little bit later in life, and the and you know, I've kind of been through a lot of different kind of stages of my own growth, and to kind of help a person come into the world and to try to figure out what you offer them, like what kind of experiences you offer this little creature mm-hmm. when they are coming into the world basically is like, you know, an animal, and but have this capacity to become, you know, who knows what. It's really curious, and it's really kind of, you know, an epic kind of opportunity, and kind of just kind of something that's humbling, you know.
You know, one of the things that you brought up earlier was theater giving you this sense of community and belonging. And it was interesting to hear you say that, because a friend of mine from high school who was in theater and also happened to be in band with me recently went back to, you know, the retirement party for the theater teacher. And he said, you know, she basically gave an entire band of people who felt they didn't belong anywhere a place to belong to. And, you know, and I've heard that, you know, it's interesting because you've echoed that sentiment. And I'm wondering in adult life how you find that sense of community in something.
You know, I think about that a lot. You know, I live in New York City. I live in Brooklyn and work in Manhattan. And this place is huge. And it's made up of lots of little communities, you know, that it, and some of them are very old and some of them are new. And, you know, everything just changes here constantly. But there is a particular kind of dynamic based on the kind of economic reality of New York, and you know, everybody's busy, everybody works really hard. And so relationships you have do, I think in my world, do tend to kind of focus around work. You know, I spend most of my day with my coworkers at Moleskin, and you know, I Moleskin's based in Italy. So I talk with people overseas quite regularly. And you know, obviously there's people in my office, and there's and then the kind of the different kind of acquaintances I make through my work of kind of working with other brands and other kind of creative people, you know, and so on. Like, that's a big piece of what my life is about. And I think the other thing I really noticed in New York is that the you know, the space that you have to occupy, like, you know, most people live in relatively small apartments, and you just don't have a ton of space to bring a lot of people together. And you know, one of the things my wife and I, you know, we met when we lived in Chicago, you know, during grad school, and, you know, there it's just a bigger, more spread out city. People tend to have a bit more space, and, you know, we tended to have the space to kind of bring people together for parties, for dinner parties and so on. And the, you know, and I think having space to enables kind of a certain kind of community, and the lack of space kind of prevents it or encourages other kinds of community. I think people tend to meet up out in the world more here in the city. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, so like having time to be together, space to be together, I think that's a big thing. I also, you know, think about, I went to school in Olympia, Washington, and lived there for about 5 years. And that city, you know, just still kind of really, you know, is very important to me. And it's like, because of the power of the community there, it has such a strong kind of sense of identity, both kind of artistically and you know, in the kind of different social communities that are there. And there's a real ethic of like, you know, gathering for potlucks and different kinds of ways of kind of sharing and expressing and so on. And that, you know, is, you know, relatively a small town, and the, you know, people tend to have more time. You're really right there on top of nature, and you can kind of go out into that if you wish. And so there's a sense that, you know, you can go down to the downtown, go to the, you know, one or two basic, you know, kind of streets that have meeting areas or bars or wherever, and you're bound to run into somebody you know. Whereas in New York, you know, once in a while, maybe I run into somebody on the subway, you know, but it, you know, or some kind of event where I know certain kind of people are going to go to, but it's, you know, it's just not the same thing. So it takes a lot more work, I feel like, to create community here. And I feel like I probably would crave more of it, and, you know, and would like to figure out ways to do it, to get, you know, deeper relationships. But I also, you know, understand that the reality of where I am is the reality of what it is.
You know, one of the questions that brings up for me, especially as somebody who has had your hands so close to events, is an observation about how we have really become obsessed almost with building online communities. And yet, I don't know that that can replace the act of getting together in person. There's something just very different about it. And it's not just not a question per se, but I'm just interested in hearing what you might have to say about that.
Yeah, I totally believe that online communities are really, they're really interesting. Like, you know, I saw online forums kind of emerge in the 90s and, you know, become things. And I've had different groups that maybe I've spent time with, and, you know, usually they're around a topic. Maybe you're sharing ideas or, you know, something you create or whatever. So you can kind of delve really deeply into kind of intellectual obsessions, or, you know, around, you know, different kinds of things you care about with other people who care about things really intensely. But you also aren't forced to put up with people in the same way as if you would, you know, kind of met them in a class at school, or, you know, if you went to an art residency, or, you know, you just kind of had to deal with them as physical people in space. It's not also not quite as efficient, you know, to be with people in physical space. Mm-hmm. But I think that I'm, you know, a relatively physical person, and I think partially what I like about performance and what I've always liked about sports and things like martial arts and so on is that, you know, it's you know, the physical embodiment of space and like the act of moving and you know, touching people, like, you know, I've always observed that if you a community of like martial artists who train together, or dancers who train together, are going to, or yoga people maybe who, you know, train together and are very kind of doing some sort of mutually supportive kind of posturing, that they're going to develop a much quicker, deeper relationship because they break through some of the kind of social boundaries that we have to do with kind of personal space and the sense of physical touch. Mm. And I think that that in itself is very, I've always seen it as a very powerful kind of insight, because it's like, you know, whenever I've kind of created events or wanted to help people kind of get comfortable with each other, or to try to express themselves in an event, you know, giving people opportunities to be together within a kind of, you know, a thoughtfully kind of constructed container of some sort, if I force them to kind of be close, or if I force them to kind of have to, like, you know, engage each other physically in some way, they're going to break through a lot of barriers a lot quicker. And there's other things too. And I think even, I mean, you know, I'm sure you have thoughts on this, just as somebody who is, you know, always talking to people. Mm-hmm. I've always liked doing interviews and different kind of conversations as well, because, you know, I think there's a difference between talking to people one-on-one, which I think is really pleasurable because you can kind of go deep and you can kind of call back on a conversation and kind of pick apart ideas. Mm-hmm. But then there's something else nice about having groups of people and having kind of, you know, multiple kind of inputs and, you know, different kinds of kind of surprises and, you know, different kinds of tones.
Yeah.
I don't know. I could talk about that stuff for a long time.
Yeah, I think you and I both could. I mean, it's like very deep and rich territory that you could spend an entire hour just talking about that alone.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would have to agree. I think there's something very intimate about having these one-on-one conversations where you get a level of depth that I don't necessarily think you get, you know, when you say, okay, here's my blog post for 1,000 people to read, but I don't have a connection to each individual reader.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and all the when we talk about any kind of art or any kind of artifice, like, you know, whether it's text or visuals or you know, some sort of physical dance or something, these are all abstractions of the world. And it's like, and, you know, for the sake of communication and for the sake of entertainment and for the sake of economics and all kinds of whatever else you're dealing with, you can't present everything. Like I think the hardest thing in art is to, like, offer up the world for what it is. Right. And like I think that's what's strong about, like, the old, like, Zen haiku type stuff, or some of the very grand kind of, like, minimalist kind of earth art type things that you see in the world. Like, you know, there's attempts to offer up the world and its wholeness, but I think life is about kind of navigating those constraints.
Hmm. Well, let's shift gears a little bit. One of the things that really intrigued me about some of what you said in the earlier part of your story was that you had attended an experimental college. Mm-hmm. And I am always very curious about education and, you know, how people have been educated in order to get to where they're at. And also, you know, for me, it always gives me an opportunity to open up the landmine of the current state of education.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really interested in hearing more about the experience of going to this experimental college.
Right. So I went to a school called the Evergreen State College. It's in Olympia, Washington. It was founded at the very kind of end of the Cultural Revolution, late 60s, maybe just like 71, something like that. Mm. And the experiment there was to create a state school that took on the mandate of, like, not having grades, not having really set classes, and, you know, kind of coming out of a lot of the free thinking type stuff of the, you know, the 60s, and trying to say, if we created curriculums that were, you know, most often seminar based, you know, around books, around the kind of conversation among peer learners, with the facilitation of a, you know, some sort of experienced, you know, kind of professor type person, that people would, you know, kind of learn well and interesting and develop as people. And, for me, you know, I thought it was a very kind of strong experience, and, you know, I could have stayed there honestly for years and years and just explored different things. I think that you know, I transferred in after doing some college credits, you know, where I grew up. And I think a lot of people do kind of transfer into that kind of program as a slightly older student. And I found that the people who didn't handle it well perhaps came right in as a freshman and like right out of high school and maybe were a little overwhelmed by the level of responsibility and freedom that you were offered. Mm-hmm. But the, you know, the idea for me, you know, I wasn't very happy with my high school kind of experience. And I, you know, I was just kind of feeling like underwhelmed by the, you know, what I was learning and how it was challenging me and kind of, you know, what I wanted to do. And I think that the idea that I could shape a class and, you know, build what they call contracts at the school was really phenomenal. Cause like, you know, you basically are mimicking the real world in the sense that you are bringing together resources like an entrepreneur might, and you are trying to put a framework around that as far as like what you hope to achieve, how you're going to measure that, and you know, kind of what you know, how you get from A to B. Then at the end, you kind of review it and you kind of get feedback, and you know, that kind of option to kind of take control of your you know, of your kind of education and of, you know, of your own kind of curiosity is, you know, I think very powerful. And I have to say, I, you know, it was in a English class that I took before that, where I kind of realized that at a certain point that I was like, I think I just took ownership of my education, like kind of, I just recognized it or something. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd always read a lot and kind of followed my curiosities, but like there was a point where I was just like surrounded in a class by people who weren't like doing like a writing assignment or something, and they're kind of like goofing off. And I was like, I'd been doing lots of creative writing classes and, you know, kind of had found that, you know, doing certain kinds of writing were really exciting to me and, you know, I had self-motivation to kind of get things done. And I think that, I recognized that suddenly there was a gap between me and some of the other students, because I had kind of discovered in that, you know, why I wanted to do these things. And then I think once I had that, going to a place like Evergreen was, you know, a good fit, because I was like, I didn't always know exactly what I was looking for and, you know, or how to get there and, you know, and what was maybe the best use of my time. And, you know, I was still like, you know, in my, you know, early 20s or whatever, but just the idea that I could kind of shape that and be a participant in what that was great. And then, you know, and just the way that I think was also powerful I took away is like, you know, they put a lot of focus on, you know, through these kind of seminars and these kind of conversations, horizontal thinking and kind of, you know, lateral thinking. So it's like opening, you know, just opening up conversations and opening up texts and, you know, kind of looking at things in a way that like, you know, encourage you to ask questions about something and, you know, kind of raise a lot of issues and kind of look at things from different perspectives and bring in different cultural points of view. And I think that that's really powerful, but also I think that's incomplete. And I think that the one thing right after I finished school there that I kind of spent some time doing is really thinking about, okay, so it's great if I can open things up in kind of a wide way, but and, you know, and there's a kind of an embedded kind of distaste for any kind of hierarchies and the kind of, you know, power structures that maybe exist in society. But still, it's like life is, you know, there's restraints and constraints and like, how do you prioritize things and how do you, you know, place value on things? Like what is better than another? Or do we just live in this kind of great blob of like everything at once? And, so I spent some time kind of thinking through that afterwards to kind of just put my mind in order a bit. But still, I think it's, you know, for the right kind of person, it's a really great experience.
There's more of my conversation with Eric after this short message from our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by Plowshares Solos, a reading subscription that delivers long-form stories and essays right to your e-reader. Longer than a typical short story, but shorter than a novel, Plowshares Solos are the perfect length to enjoy while drinking your morning coffee, on your commute, or relaxing after work. Buy a Plowshares Solo subscription now to make picking out your next read easy. Every month, you'll get a new story or essay delivered automatically to your Kindle, Nook, or smartphone for just $10. Visit pshares.org/creative to buy a year's worth of reading now. How do you know these stories are going to be worth your time? Plowshares is a world-renowned literary journal that's been publishing award-winning literature since 1971. Work first published in Plowshares is selected continuously for annual prize anthologies such as the Best American Poetry, Best American Short Stories, the O. Henry Awards, and the Pushcart Prize. These stories are coming from one of the most prominent publishers out there, so you can trust they're going to be great. Subscribe today and get a year's worth of stories for just $10 a year. Visit PSHARES.org/creative. Now, let's get back to the show. As somebody who's about to become a father, how does that experience make you think about education in its current state and how you plan to educate your own son?
I don't know. I mean, my wife, she has spent a lot of time, working with nonprofits, art nonprofits, and doing education. And so she has got really strong opinions about it and probably knows more, particularly about the education of younger folks than I do. So it's like, to some degree, I'm going to look to her for her thoughts. But, I think we're likely candidates for doing some sort of alternative education, Montessori type thing or something early on. I need to look into it more to really figure out, I guess, my position on that piece. But I do think project-based learning is powerful. I think being exposed to lots of stuff and, different cultures is powerful. But, I think that also from my experience when I've taught college, I've always just kind of asked questions and felt like I'm pretty good at listening. And I think that, if you can kind of be perceptive, I think you can help people learn. And so the first thing I think to do with a kid is just to listen to them, and especially at the very beginning. And I kind of feel like I'm getting also this feedback from people when they talk to me about newborns is that, they can't communicate very well, but they do communicate all the time. And so the first thing you have to do is learn what their cries and their movements are, and the basic things they're trying to express as far as hunger and, whatever. And so I think that just listening to who this person is and trying to kind of decode them as much as I can, as a starting point, it's probably something that will be with me as it grows. I do think there's a lot of experiments going on in education, whether from people who are building programs that are around, game kind of systems or, other kinds of ideas, whether it's like reading classical kind of literature or whatever. I think they probably all have certain merits and at the end of the day, if I was creating like an experience, I would probably do something that looks like Evergreen's kind of very open curriculum. I would probably make that something more like you experienced in high school. And then, what I experienced in grad school, which is a little bit more focused, I think is more what I think college should look like. And then, I think grad school should be probably just a, kind of a deeper kind of, experience that looks something more like a PhD or something that looks more like a incubator for startups or something like that. But who knows, it's like the kid might end up being, going to like, a frat school or something.
Well, let's do this. Let's talk a little bit about how to build an iconic brand. I mean, one of the things you mentioned was that you really are sort of, a catalyst for the brand values of this brand that people absolutely love. Like it, by all logical accounts, it makes no sense that I spend $20 on a notebook, but I have stacks of them and I swear by them. So I want to talk about how that happens and what it is that drives that kind of fanaticism and evangelism for a brand.
Sure. Well, it's a big, it's a big topic. And I think that Moleskine has a lot going for it. I think most people know Moleskine, the brand, for the notebooks and, inherent in the design of that object, which is a very nice design and is a lot of ideas that are bigger than that object. And, we think of them as, platforms for people's imagination and for organizing their lives and, spaces that are both public and private. And and that comes from this idea it's a blank page. And I think that from that one idea, you can kind of talk about like how Moleskine communicates the brand nowadays. You can talk about how that's kind of been a driver behind how we've kind of expanded the company in terms of collections. And, we make bags and pens and different things now. But also I think, any brand is kind of built around at least three kind of pillars to me. It's like the, there's that functional design and the kind of aesthetic design of that object. That's obviously has to be quality, or, a brand is not going to be able to hold itself up if that base isn't there. The community that it gathers around it is also very important. Just one thing I might say about Moleskine community is that, they're all, it's a very impressive group of people to me, and, they're always very creative people. A lot of production happens inside of Moleskine Notebooks, and Moleskine was fortunate to kind of come up in the late 90s, right around the time blogs were starting, and, and people needed something to fill their blogs with. So they would take pictures of what they would create in their notebooks, and they would take pictures of the kind of hacks that they would do their notebooks, like, the Get Things Done community, for instance, were early adopters of the Moleskine notebook and, would hack it up to make it fit to the kind of organizational system that, they found. And I think that, so that community really takes the inherent viral nature of the object and, the fact that it's a blank page that they then, kind of put their creativity into and add color to, and then they, have their own kind of incentive to share it. And now that, paired with all these kind of, technological tools we have now, they're able to share it, quite broadly. Mm-hmm. That community is able to, really kind of help the brand grow, but also to find each other and kind of, share the esteem of, making things together, which is, in line with what Moleskine is about. And I think the other thing is the values. And, I think that the founders have been very good at keeping the Moleskine brand consistent to, a core feeling of values. And, the words change a little bit now and then, but it's still kind of, tied to kind of an appreciation for and support of kind of talented people, and not just in the sense of grand artists, but like the and not just artists of the past, but like artists today, but also anybody, whatever people do well. And culture and creativity is so broad now, it includes things like writing and drawing and those kind of classic disciplines, but it's also gardening and, making robots, or like, organizing outings, or, making, your own knives, or, whatever. And it's like the, so you find people who are inspired by, objects and that contain the values that are associated with Moleskine, in startup culture and, traditional kind of creative disciplines of design, architecture, and art. But also in moms and, Wall Street folks. And, I've met bankers who tell me that they, use a Moleskine notebook when they wake up at 2 a.m. and they have an idea. It's like, that notion of kind of talent is broad and is really rooted in, a notion of inclusivity and trying to kind of be able to speak to this very broad kind of community of people that we kind of have taken on Moleskine as an object that they enjoy. And I think that, also just, notions of kind of being open and exploring the world is obviously very powerful. And I think, we're also thinking in terms of like, personal identity. These are symbols that people take on that are not just about, fashion, but about, self-expression and about kind of, creating the symbols that, people might want to have close to them, as they move about the world. I also probably would throw out just, it's useful to think about the insight that was behind the brand, when it kind of got founded. And, this woman, Maria, who's the VP of the brand, you might say, she's still part of the company, and she heads up the group that I'm a part of. She kind of came up with the idea of Moleskine, and she you know, discovered the word moleskin in a book by an English travel writer named Bruce Chatwin. He wrote a book called Songlines. It's kind of a travel kind of memoir, looking at Australia and Aborigines out there, and this kind of poetic notion of travel that they have, where they kind of follow these what they call song lines, and there's like a song that kind of leads you across these grand landscapes, and it's like, you know, this notion of being able to wander anywhere and to kind of explore the world, but it's not just about like travel as far as a place, but it's about a journey, and it's a journey that transforms you. And like, so this notion of travel, and you know, it was really tied to the early notion of Moleskin as a brand. And you know, he used to write about his notebooks, and he called them Moleskin notebooks. You know, these are more important to me than my passport, because all of his ideas and writings were inside of them. And so Maria found this, and she was like, "Oh yeah, I remember these notebooks." That, you know, she was living in Paris in, you know, her youth, and up until the 80s, this style of notebook was made by bookbinders there. And so she kind of tracked it down and figured out how they disappeared, and you know, kind of put this together, and recognized early on that, you know, as kind of global travel becomes more affordable, you know, as kind of the price of an airline ticket, you know, kind of went down, a kind of global class of kind of nomadic people would emerge. And, you know, this, you know, ultimately this kind of creative class of travelers would need objects like a Moleskin notebook to kind of help distinguish who they were.
Hmm. Wow. So one of the questions that raises for me about these sort of three pillars of a brand, design, community, and values, is how people might bring that into their own work.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about it a lot lately, and I think that, you know, I'm still unpacking in my ideas around this, but you know, I think you can use it first as if you're starting a new brand, you can use it as a check. You know, it's like, am I taking into account community? Am I taking into account the design? Am I thinking about design in terms of just function, or am I thinking of it and also in terms of kind of aesthetics? Or am I just creating something that's kind of a shallow design? It's decorated, but, you know, is not a usable object. And then in terms of values, like, what are my values? And, you know, when I look at my values of my brand or thing I'm making, are they something that propels the brand forward? Like, you know, it's like, there's not a lot of objects, honestly, like a notebook. Like, it's such a great object for building a brand around because of that blank page, because of the simplicity, particularly of the minimalist kind of design that Moleskin chose, you know, because people project themselves onto it. So it can be a thing for so many kinds of people. Hmm. And I think that, you know, creating brands inside of cultural space is like, that's the best place to be located, because it's like, you know, it's just so positive and so empowering to people. And like, and I think that, you know, you're going to get interesting people there, and your community are going to be interesting people. And like, that in itself is going to attract people to the project you're doing. And I think Moleskin, I've always thought of it as much of a creative project as it is a business. And I think that, you know, obviously it exists inside the marketplace, and it, you know, people are paying money for these notebooks, but, you know, I think that it also does good in the sense it's creating space for people to tell stories and to create work. And the notebooks, like you mentioned with your notebooks, and I hear this a lot, like, you know, they're designed to be kept, they're not disposable objects, and people end up with these shelves full of them. Mm-hmm. And and they become more valuable with use. And you can't say that about a lot of stuff. Because yeah, a lot of stuff is presented to you finished, you know, and it's like there's not room for you to add yourself to it. So if you can, anybody can create an object that, you know, has strong values, particularly if they're values that kind of are tied to this kind of productive cultural world, you know, if you can create objects that are well designed, you know, both from a utilitarian and a kind of aesthetic point of view, but then also in that object maybe leave some space for the user to kind of put themselves into it. And then if you can kind of attract a kind of creative audience, I think you're at a good starting point for sure. Hmm.
You know, one of my favorite things that you said, was this idea of a transformational journey.
And it's funny because when you said that, I thought every one of my notebooks is actually a transformational journey that makes up the chapters of my life.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we're always, life is a journey, right? And yeah. it's they're big ideas. And I think that that's one thing I like about Moleskine is like there are big ideas inside of the company. But it's interesting too, because like, you know, we talk about, and Maria's really, really thinks about this deeply, is that, we're tied to travel, and, you know, travel is really about what we are, but travel changes, you know, the notion of travel changes with time. And like, it's the way people kind of experience travel and mobility isn't just about that grand journey to Patagonia or to Australia or something now. It's also about this, you know, the little journey you take down the street to the cafe where you pull out your laptop and you're working on your startup or whatever. And it's also that kind of creative journey that, you know, a novelist or screenwriter or somebody goes through when they open up their notebook and they are telling the tale. And, you know, all these things are things that change us and, you know, help us grow. And I think, kind of like we were talking about with events, I think that, you know, if you can offer people experiences that have a level of depth and, you know, help them break through something, changes them a bit. And like, they're always, that's going to be unlock emotion and create true relationships. And whether that's just through simple human contact or through the act of creativity, which I also think is another really powerful insight for, you know, events, you know, it's like whenever I do events, you know, if I can create a situation where people are making something together, I'm going to create community. And the same thing, I think, with Moleskine in a much broader kind of distributed way. And it's like out right now, there's people, millions of people all over the place filling up Moleskine notebooks with their kind of dreams and ideas and drawings. And they are kind of a big global community of kind of creative production happening. And it's the same kind of thing that's happening on YouTube. It's the same kind of thing that's happening through a platform like Kickstarter. It's the same kind of thing that's happening inside of kind of laptops everywhere. You know, it's like places that are platforms for people to kind of express themselves.
Huh. So let's do this. Let's talk a little bit about why pen and paper has remained so prevalent in an increasingly digital world. You being in the position you're in must have a really interesting perspective on this.
This is, yeah, obviously it's another thing that we think about a lot. And I think notions of kind of handwriting, the handmade, that's one of the topics we talk about a lot. You see a lot of stuff about this in the press when you look for Moleskine. And I think that, you know, Moleskine doesn't take an antagonistic view on the digital world. You know, we're designing for the digital world. We are within the digital world. The brand came up, like I mentioned, because in part the digital world enabled the sharing of the things that were happening inside the notebook. And there's something, you know, just aesthetically very pleasing about that kind of black rectangle of the classic notebook. And, you know, I remember when BlackBerry tried to make a play to do a tablet, you know, they mentioned how that, you know, they looked to the Moleskine notebook for inspiration around the design. And when the iPad mini came out, is like somebody did an article around the curve of the corner of the mini exactly matches the curve of the Moleskine notebook. And like, none of this is like planned, you know, it's like, no, I don't think that neither Apple nor Moleskine designed the curve to match, but there is something inherently, pleasing about that shape and about how it fits as an object that you want to carry with you. And so there's like these kind of aesthetic kind of connections within the digital world. And, you know, the notion of travel and mobility, kind of like we were talking about it, you know, is also connected, you know, because it's enabled by, you know, Wi-Fi and mobile devices and laptops to, you know, be able to go work in that cafe. So, you know, we find our users have a smartphone in their pocket and they have a notebook in their pocket. They know how to jump between both. They have their workflows down. And if anything, people design a very particular workflow for themselves. And that's part of how they kind of express themselves and mature as kind of productive, creative people. But then also we see the way that people relate to the analog world, doing things like handwriting, putting a pen to paper, like the meaning of that changes. Like it becomes more of a conscious act and, you know, something that you know, perhaps it's done for leisure or is done for a specific kind of purpose, because you don't have to write a letter anymore. But if you write a letter in this day and age, it's going to have impact because nobody writes letters anymore. You know, everybody's typing things all the time. Mm-hmm. And then certainly, you know, people have been doing research around the way that, you know, the physical experience of writing affects your memory and how you learn, and, you know, just that kind of, I think it's a broader sensory experience in a way than, you know, maybe doing using a touchscreen or a keyboard. So it's like, it's a dialogue, you know, the analog and the digital, they're in relationship and they're always kind of shifting and kind of, you know, influencing each other. But, you know, it's like the analog world's not going away. You know, anybody who's kind of like saying like, you know, books are going to go away, or, you know, the pencil is going to go away, you know, I think is, you know, kind of trying to sell you something.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I remember thinking that when I sat down with a Moleskine, suddenly all of the constraints that I had on a computer were gone. Mm-hmm. That the tool that apparently is, you know, filled with all these infinite possibilities was actually limited by its features and functions.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a different set of constraints, honestly. Yeah. It's like, and I think one thing that's really beautiful about the Moleskine design is that there are very subtle constraints baked into that design that maybe you don't realize and are very gentle, and but are there. And I think, like, one, I you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about this, but over, like, one thing I think just in the narrative of going through a book that is really amazing is the, is like, you open up a new book and, like, the first thing you encounter is this in case of loss page that's in the front, right? And it's the only bit of the book that's really structured in one of our standard kind of classic notebooks, right? Yeah. It asks you, you know, what's your name, you know, and in case of loss, you know, where can you be contacted, and like, and what is the reward you would offer for that book? And, you know, that's charming because, like, people obviously are, you know, this is your first chance to kind of really personalize this thing and to create an attachment to it. You're claiming it as yours, which is powerful in itself. You're putting your name on it. Uh-huh. You're choosing how the outside world might encounter this thing and, you know, how they're going to reach you. So you have this idea that this could be a public object at some point. You are also thinking about, like, what's the value of this thing? And it's not like, you know, the $20, whatever you've spent for this book, it's what it will be worth once you put your ideas into it. And, like, is that worth, and then how do you quantify that? Like, is that worth a bunch of money to you? Is it worth, like, a hug? Is it, you know, are you poetic about it? Or are you kind of practical? Like, it, you know, how do you interpret this question? And it's a very simple question, but it can go in all these different directions. And by the time you just answer those three basic questions, you've built a much deeper emotional connection to this book and what it will be. You've imagined what it will be. And, like, you have also broken the seal on this thing, which can come off as very perfect and, like, you know, kind of the blank page and all the intimidation that comes with the blank page. Right. But now it's not perfect anymore. You've marked it. It's broken. So you can kind of break it some more and start writing it, you know? And I think that, you know, that's really amazing. Hmm.
Well, Eric, this has been really cool. Really, really thought-provoking and insightful. One of those conversations that I think we'll have to replay over and over again just to, you know, get everything out of it that you packed into it. And, you know, hopefully we'll fill lots of Moleskine notebooks with insights and observations from our conversation. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
How do you make somebody unmistakable? I think that, you know, I think there's always two pieces to anything kind of having the ring of truth. And it's like, on one hand, it's your own feeling. Like, have you lived up to what you hope to do, or have you put your all into it? Have you spent the time you need to spend to kind of satisfy you? Have you, you know, kind of like athletes talk about, you know, leaving it all in the court or something. And then it's also the public, and it's the, you know, the audience and your peers and your community. And do they respond and do they acknowledge what you've created? And I think that whether you're talking about science and like the scientific method and the confirmation that people are, you know, kind of evaluating everybody's work to see if what they're coming up with is true, or you're talking about artwork, which is often romanticized as a solo endeavor that, you know, it only exists to please the artist. I think that's not true. I think that all art, you know, really comes into being and becomes a communication when it's in front of other people. So I think that, I think probably that, that really truly unmistakable moment is when you have those moments that you feel like you've put yourself fully into something, you feel true about what you do, and it's also recognized by the people.
Hmm. Well, this has been great, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your story, your journey, and your insights with our listeners.
Hey, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your questions, and just, you know, it's always a privilege just to have someone take the time and listen to you, you know? It's like, I appreciate you kind of, you know, validating my ideas. That's great.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.